You're listening to a special podcast recorded by the Central London Humanist Group on the 27th of November 2012. In this podcast, you'll hear Professor A.C. Grayling talk about the roots and fruits of humanism. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine program about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a skeptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, here's A.C. Grayling.
Thank you very much. Well, the title of my talk this evening is The Roots and Fruits of Humanism. And it wasn't just the poetic rhyme scheme of that title that seduced me into using it, but the fact that when we look at the roots of a system of ideas, we learn a great deal about them. And when we look at their fruits, we learn even more. So I thought it might be of interest to those of you who are already interested in humanism to reflect a little bit, perhaps on things that you know already, but then educational psychologists tell us that people like to hear what they already know. It's sort of comforting. I find that this helps my lectures at the university. I always say things four times so that by the end of the hour, people will have picked something up to take home with them and will have a sense of familiarity, of really having encountered the ideas before. The roots of humanism lie in classical antiquity. They lie deep in the origins of the philosophical tradition of our Western civilization, and they are very similar to some of the deep trains of thought and traditions of thought that you find in India and in China. It's something rather little known, as Michael Caine might say, that the Indian traditions count among them a number of very fine and complex non-religious or atheist traditions. And two of the great Chinese traditions, the Confucian tradition and the Taoist tradition, are non-religious in the sense that, although the Taoists always talked about the way, about the Tao. Thank you, that's awfully kind. They didn't have in mind some conscious agency with a set of purposes for us, with a set of views about what we should wear and who we can have sex with and what days we should eat certain kinds of food and so on. But rather, like the Stoics in the Greek tradition, they thought of nature, of the world itself, as having a kind of order, a principle to it, which, if we could live in conformity with that, would allow us to live well, to live flourishing, good lives. And this was something that was very much a key to the thinking of the classical period. And just in a sort of seven-league boots kind of way, in order to situate what I'm talking about, I think the 5th and 6th century in Greece, and especially in Athens, for something very close to 1,000 years, up to, let us say, about the 4th century of the Common Era, as we used to say, the 4th century AD, the thinking of the classical schools, the Greek and Hellenic and then the Roman schools of thought, were dominant among educated people. Nearly 1,000 years before Christianity became the dominant outlook in the European world. And when it did so, it of course, short-circuited the discussion that people had with one another about the nature of the good and what would be meant by a well-lived life, a life lived with some nobility and dignity. Because, of course, the religious view had a raft of answers. If people wanted to know how they should live, what sort of people they should be, what choices they should make, what really is valuable in life, and what the aim, the purpose, the goal of living is, then the faith had this set of answers which were definitive. And for another 1,000 years, there was very little discussion of the basis of ethics. There was very little discussion other than what came to be called casuistry, that is the rather fine debates about just when sunset is so you can end your fast, or just where you would be pushing the margins of permissibility and how many people you could marry and so on. And it wasn't really until the early modern period, 17th and in particular the 18th century, that the liberty of conscience was sufficient for people to think again about the question of the basis of the good. In the 17th, and particularly in the 18th centuries, thinkers were able to go back to one of the dialogues of Plato, the Euthyphro, which I know you were all reading in the bath last night, so you're familiar with the point I'm about to make. And you'll remember that in the Euthyphro, the problem which is posed is this. Are the gods good because they conform to the moral law? Or is the moral law good because the gods ordained them? Is God good because he is obedient to the moral law? Or is the moral law what it is because God says what it is? And in the Euthyphro dialogue itself, and Plato makes his interlocutors in the dialogue recognize that if things are good because the gods say so, then if the gods said that rape and murder are good, they would have to be good. Yet this seems very counterintuitive. Human reason and sentiment would be against thinking that such things could be acceptable. But if the gods are good because they themselves conform to a moral law, then you only need to know the moral law. You don't need to know about the gods. And so in the 18th century, and particularly in the hands of people like Hume and Shaftesbury, Hutcheson and others who were thinking about these matters again and asking themselves, what are the principles, what are the sources of our thinking about the nature of the good? They found that it was necessary to return to the ancient debate about these matters. And indeed, they were much influenced by the work of Cicero. Cicero was a sort of collector of ideas. He wasn't himself an original thinker, but he was a writer of very beautiful Latin, and he was a sort of syncretist. He brought together accounts of the earlier views of the philosophical tradition. And Hume in particular, David Hume, great 18th century Enlightenment thinker, said that when he first encountered Cicero and saw how vastly superior he and the ideas that he reported were in comparison, for example, to religious tracts, he thought, as Erasmus before him had done, that Cicero should be beatified, or indeed made a saint. Erasmus, you may remember, said, we should call him Saint Cicero. Well, so this redirects our attention. When we think about the origins of thinking humanistically about life, about the world around us, about our relationships to other people, when we think about it, we are directed back to those debates that the ancients had with one another about these very matters. And they had them because they lived at a time of very great significance indeed for the way that we think about ourselves, about us as human beings, premised on a recognition of the fact that we are essentially social creatures. We need our relationships with one another. We need to give and to receive love. We need friendship. We need an opportunity in our communities to flourish. It's a very, very rare human being who can be an island, as John Donne says, no man is an island. But nobody other than a very rare individual could be a complete solitary. And it was this thinking about the nature of the kinds of values and kinds of virtues which are necessary for a life that is good for an individual to live and which is good in the relationships that individuals can form with one another, that we see the origins of ethical thinking. And I mentioned this to some of you before in this very place, but there is, as it were, a photograph of that moment, the moment of change in the history of our civilization, when this realization really came to be. It's a verbal photograph. It is the last, only remaining full trilogy from classical antiquity, Aeschylus's The Oresteia. So that was the other thing you were reading in the bath last night. Okay, the Eumenides, the third of the trilogy. And you'll remember the story that Aeschylus tells. It's a fantastic soap opera. I mean, it beats the pants off EastEnders or Coronation Street or anything when you think about it. Because you remember what happened. In Troy, King Priam had a family of sons and daughters, and one of his sons, Paris, handsome young man, was a bit of a wastrel, was getting into scrapes, and so his father sent him out into the fields to be a shepherd for a while. While he was there, he was visited by the three most senior goddesses of the Olympian pantheon. And this has nothing to do with the fact that these goddesses were Greek, but they wanted him to choose which one of them was the most beautiful, and they each offered him a bribe. And Hera, who was the queen of the gods, said, if you choose me, I will give you dominion over great empires. And Athene said, if you choose me, I will give you wisdom. And Aphrodite said, if you choose me, you can have any girl you like. And he said, I choose you. So she gave him the magic power, and he was soon after, as you know, sent off on an embassy to the kingdom of Menelaus, the younger brother of King Agamemnon, who was the king of kings in the Greek world. And there he met Helen, the beautiful Helen, so beautiful indeed that her face, as legend has it, launched the 1,000 ships of the Greek invasion fleet that went to Troy when Paris stole her away and took her to Troy, and the Greeks went to fetch her back because Menelaus was naturally cross that his wife had been pinched, and he went to see his big brother Agamemnon. He said, my wife's been pinched. Agamemnon said, right, we'll get a great army and we'll go and beat up the Trojans and get her back. By the way, little footnote, Helen's face launched 1,000 ships. This gives you a system of aesthetic calibration. A Millie Helen, just enough beauty to launch one ship. So now you know how to evaluate it. And you'll remember from the story that the Greek fleet couldn't set sail because of the prevailing winds. Winds were against them, day after day, week after week, month after month, and the fleet couldn't go. Timbers of the ships began to rot, soldiers became mutinous, the supplies were running out. So Agamemnon had an auger find out why it was that the gods wouldn't answer their prayers and let them set sail. And it turned out that one of their number killed some creature sacred to Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, and that they had to make a great sacrifice to appease her wrath. And the sacrifice was nothing less than Agamemnon's daughter, Iphigenia. So she was taken and sacrificed. The winds changed. Fleet set sail. 10 years, war, Trojan horse, end of Troy. And Agamemnon set sail back home again. And now this bit of the story is where the real interest starts, because, of course, his wife, Clytemnestra, was, as you would expect, a little bit annoyed that he had sacrificed their daughter. In any case, she had taken up with her lover, Aegisthus, cousin of Agamemnon, who thought that he should be the king. So they plotted to murder Agamemnon when he got back, and indeed they did. Now, Agamemnon and Clytemnestra had a son called Orestes, and it was Orestes' duty, according to the old morality, to revenge the murder of his father. And since his mother had murdered his father, he had to kill his mother, and so he did. And it was also part of the ancient morality that anybody who committed parenticide, murdered a parent, killed a parent, was to be persecuted and punished by the Furies, the Erinyes, as they were known. That was their duty. They were Chthonic deities who would pursue and torment and finally destroy anybody who had done so terrible a thing. And so the Furies began to chase after Orestes all over the Greek world. He ended up at the oracle of Apollo at Delphi to ask his advice. What the heck am I going to do? You know, my mum killed my dad. I had to revenge him, so I had to kill her, and now I'm in trouble. And Apollo said, look, if I were you, I would go to Athens and speak to my very, very clever sister, Athene. She'll know what to do. And Apollo put the Furies to sleep so that Orestes could escape. And he went to Athens, and there he explained his problem to Athene. And she said, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'm going to summon a jury of Athenian citizens, and we're going to discuss this case, and we're going to decide what to do. So they did that. Apollo served as Orestes' defense counsel, and he argued that Orestes hadn't committed parenticide because a mother is not a parent, she's just a receptacle. This is not an argument that would wash much today, but half of the Athenian jury accepted this argument and voted to release him, and the other half didn't. It shows you that they were fairly smart. Athene used her casting vote to acquit him. And just as she did so, the Furies turned up in Athens. And as was their wont, they were furious. They said to Athene, you young gods, this is the really interesting phrase, you young gods have usurped our role. Here you are, somebody who's killed his mother. It's our duty to punish him. But you've had this discussion, jaw, and you've let him off. You've usurped our function. And Athene said, yes, I have. This is a new world. Now we have to think and discuss and agree about how we're to live. We have to choose our values, our aims, our goals, as a result of consideration among ourselves. We no longer stick to the old way of doing things by revenge, by strength. It's no longer a case of might is right. And this is a, that trilogy, that last play of the trilogy, is as it were a snapshot of the moment when history changed, turned on its hinge. For think of this, think of the word virtue. Now that word has a, it's of course a Latin origin, but the first syllable, as you'll remember from your happy Latin studies, ver, or as my old Latin master used to call it, vir, which I thought was weird, but anyway, ver, V-I-R, means man, it means male, doesn't mean human being. And virtue was strength, courage, fortitude, endurance, the ability to put up with cold and danger, to defend the tribe, to defend the city. The virtues were warrior virtues, the virtues of indomitable strength and ferocity in battle. But what Athene demonstrated by summoning a jury, by having a discussion, by working out, by conversation, what was to be done, had turned everything on its head. And no longer was virtue a matter of strength, of the manly characteristics of courage and endurance, but instead there were civic virtues, virtues of cooperation, of collaboration, of living together, of taking into consideration the feelings and interests and needs of others. So it really is a hinge moment in history, captured by that play. And it's quite an extraordinary insight into a whole new way of thinking. Now, if we were to fast forward from the 5th century, from the time of Aeschylus, to the end of the 1st century of the Common Era, about 100 AD, there you would get another insight into how somebody more than 5 centuries later was thinking about these matters, the matters of ethics. And this is something that you would get from Plutarch's wonderful essay, The Dinner of the Seven Wise Men. Now, alas, it is always men who were having dinner in ancient times. Ladies don't seem to be mentioned, but in fact there were two very, very formidable and clever ladies at that dinner, Melissa and Eumetis. You might like to look them up. But that wonderful essay begins with a description of two of the sages, the person whose voice it is, who tells the story of the dinner, and Solon, the great lawgiver of Athens, on their way to the dinner and discussing the question of the duties of a guest at a dinner party. You know, the one says to the other one, we know what a host must do. He's got to provide the wine, the entertainment, the food. But what's the duty of a guest? And the answer was, and this may be very familiar to you, the duty of a guest is to be a good conversationalist. That is, somebody who is informed and thoughtful, reflective, who knows some things, who can articulate them, explain them, defend them in debate, but who is also a very good listener. Now, we know that most of the problems in the world come from the fact that we think we've heard people say certain things, although they didn't really say them, and we always hear what we think people have said. But to be really attentive, to engage with somebody else's viewpoint, to see where they're coming from, to be able to draw them out, to discuss with them their views, to debate them, challenge them if necessary, but to be a good listener. So to be a good conversationalist, a good guest at a dinner party, is to be an informed and thoughtful person who's able to hear and to engage, who's attentive. And that is exactly what it is to be a good guest at the dinner of life, to be informed and engaged and attentive, to be somebody who is alert, observant, and receptive, and who wants to do what Emerson said we should do for our fellow human beings, and that is to give them the same advantage we give a painting, which is the advantage of a good light. Now, this attitude to others and to life, this way of approaching life, this idea of being a certain sort of person, the person who is a good guest in other people's lives, is deeply a humanist view. And it comes out of this rich tradition that begins in the classical period of Athenian philosophy and works all the way through to the second, third century of the Common Era in the thinking of the Stoics. Because as you know, you've probably read Marcus Aurelius and you've read Epictetus and others, the late Stoic moral thinkers, and you will know that there is a very simple, very profound moral attitude, or I should say, more generally speaking, an ethical attitude in the writings of those thinkers, which is distinctively humanist. And that is to face those things that we have no control over, things like disease and age and tsunamis and earthquakes, but to face them with courage and with respect to the things that we have some control over, our appetites, our fears, to achieve some degree of mastery, of self-mastery. So that if one had mastery over one's appetites and courage with respect to the world around one, one would live with the nobility and the dignity that the Stoic ideal presents to us. And I say this is deeply humanist for the following reason. You will notice that that outlook, that description of what it is to be a good guest in Plutarch, or what it is to live with some dignity as a Stoic, makes no reference whatever to any external agency, to any tradition of thought, to any sacred text, to any divine command. It is wholly a matter of what the mature-minded, sensible person would think at their best moments, just as we, in our best moments, tend to be very good friends to those we care about and who need our advice or our help. Then we are true humanists because we advise them as best we may about how they can deal with problems. A humanist is somebody who is a very good friend to himself or herself in just that same way, in taking good advice about how to live on the basis of our own insights, experience, and in particular our learning from the great conversation of mankind. Now, when you go back and you look at classical antiquity, when you read people like Aristotle, for example, in particular Aristotle, but also Epicurus, or also Aurelius and Epictetus, you notice something very distinctive about them. If you read the Nicomachean Ethics, and this is the great work by Aristotle, it sounds very formidable, Nicomachean, you know, any time that a multiplicity of syllables appears on the horizon, people run in the opposite direction. It just happens that Nicomachus was Aristotle's son, and he edited Aristotle's works. Alas, all the dialogues that Aristotle wrote are lost. And in ancient times, they had the reputation of being very, very beautiful. Plato was a wonderful writer, a terrible fascist, of course, but his writings are wonderful. And it was said of Aristotle that his dialogues were very beautiful. And, of course, all the works that remain to us, and there are many, are rather rough-hewn, but that's because they are lecture notes. And it's always astonished me, actually, those great thick wadges of lecture notes of Aristotle's that we now have. And he was said to lecture walking up and down, hence his school was known as the Peripatetic School. God knows how his students managed, scurrying after him up and down the stoa as he talked about metaphysics and these other things. So when he died, he left all these lecture notes, and they were edited by his successors, and they had to make up titles for these works. Some were very obvious, the physics, which is about physics, and the on the soul, the de anima, and so on and so on. And then, of course, they came across this very, very strange work, which began, this is a treatise on the concept of being qua being, that is, of what existence is, what the most fundamental kind of existence is. And they couldn't think of a title for this work. They tried everything. Gone with the Wind, Pride and Prejudice, it didn't quite work. So they ended up just calling it the book that came after the physics, because they'd just been editing the physics, and this was the metaphysics. That's why it's called that. Meta means after. But the Nicomachean Ethics was edited by his son Nicomachus, which is why it's so called. But it is a treatise on ethics, and it is a very accessible read if you pay it some attention. It's the kind of book that you might read not only in the bath, but also in bed. So just give it a little bit of chance. And you will see as you get to chapter 7 and 8, probably one of the most beautiful accounts of the nature of friendship, which is the great relationship between human beings. As you know, if you and your lover can become friends, even if you remain lovers, if you can become friends with your children when they grow up, you can become friends with your parents when you grow up, friends with your colleagues. Ultimately, friendship is the great achievement in human relationships. And Aristotle was very interested in the nature of that relationship, of the bond between people, where they treasure one another, help one another, can rely on one another. His view of friendship might be a little bit excessive. He said a friend is another self. All his interests are your own. There is a nuance that one would like to add to that, provided by Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde said, a friend is somebody who stabs you in the front. And that's actually quite a useful function performed by friends occasionally. But you can see that this is a book, the Nicomachean Ethics, a book about how a thoughtful person might work out how to live well, how to act well, how to make choices which respect the difficulties of situations. There's no thou shalt and thou shalt not in Aristotle. There is an invitation, or indeed a challenge, to think for yourself about how you're going to navigate through difficulties in life. And when he talks about the virtues, when he talks about what it is to be courageous or generous, kind, he said, the virtuous thing in any circumstance is the middle path between vicious extremes, contrasting virtue and vice. So generosity, for example, is the middle path between meanness and profligacy. And courage is the middle path between overboldness on the one hand and timidity on the other. But it will depend on cases, and you can judge on the merits of the case how you should behave in that situation. And this is a very wise and a very humane, a very sensible, down-to-earth approach to the question of ethics, which is, after all, the great discussion about how we should live, what we should be, what kind of people, what choices we should make. And that is why these views, the views of Aristotle, the views of the Stoics, the views of Plutarch, that's why they are humanist. Because when we ask ourselves the question, what do we mean by humanism today? Fundamentally, we mean an outlook on life which premises itself on two things. Firstly, the most generous, the most sympathetic attempt to understand human nature and the human condition and how best we can relate to it. And the second thing is our best understanding, our most intellectually responsible understanding of the world around us. So it's a view that demands of us that we inform ourselves, demands of us that we be reflective and thoughtful, always learning, always trying to make sense of things, always listening, being very attentive, like that good guest. Humanism is not a body of doctrine so much as an attitude, a practice. It's a key feature of Aristotle's view about the well-lived life, that it is a matter of practice, that we keep on trying to do better, to be good, to do the worthwhile things. Not necessarily to be good in a kind of conventional Victorian moralistic sort of way. Once years ago I wrote a little book called Moral Values, which all my friends said should be called Immoral Values, because it didn't seem to conform greatly to any conventional views about marriage and sexuality and drug taking and so on. But that's because our conventional morality, derived as it is from a long-standing religious tradition, is one which tries to control by cutting across the grain of human nature in ways that humanists simply can't accept, because a humanist's attitude towards the complexity of human nature and the fact of grief and darkness and struggle and difficulty in life is a very sympathetic one. And then one which is somehow not tolerated in certain versions of a divine command morality, because to be depressed or to feel desire or to yield to it is to fail and is to stain your soul with sin. The ancient Greeks didn't think in those terms. They thought in terms of amartia, which means a bad shot. You know, if you fail in some way, you fail a friend or you do something wrong, it's like having aimed your arrow at a target and missed. Well, what do you do then? You take aim again and you shoot better. Whereas in the case of a moral outlook which says failure is something for which you're going to have to pay. Every failure represents an accumulation of charge. So you sin today, you're going to have to purge that in purgatory or somehow get rid of it. It's not simply a matter of doing better and succeeding. Whereas then for Aristotle, for the Epicureans, for the Stoics, the idea was failure is an opportunity to do better next time. Not that that's an invitation to fail, by the way, although casuist, of course, would say so. I think I'll just have a little failure here so I can do better next time. No, the point is that it's a very authentic outlook. It's one where you are genuinely and sincerely trying to do the thing that makes life good to live and good in its effect on other people. And that can only stem from this demand on oneself to try generously and sympathetically to understand oneself and others. And that's the basis of the humanist position. So that's the roots of the humanist position. The fruits of them are obvious to us in the world today, if only we would look. Firstly, we look at the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment of the 18th century broke the chains of thought in one very, very major respect. That up until that time, the great majority of humankind had been told, and alas, it remains the case that the great majority of humankind today is told, that there is only one right way to think and to live. There's one correct answer, one truth. We must all be servants of it. We must submit ourselves to it. Christianity tells us we have to die to the self and accept the governance of something external to ourselves. The very word Islam means submission. And so, for hundreds of years, indeed thousands of years, people were told not to think, but to obey, not to exercise freedom, not to accept the challenge of liberty, but to submit. The other thing you were reading in the bath last night was Immanuel Kant's wonderful essay, What is Enlightenment? And that's where he says those things. Dare to know. Dare to think for yourself. Recognize that you have been under this constant whip of being told not to think for yourself and to obey the authorities, the absolute monarch, the priest or the bishop. But think for yourself. Can be frightening, but it's can be wonderful as well because it's so liberating once you've accepted that challenge. And the 18th century told us, or reminded us perhaps, of something that was obvious to the people in classical times, of the diversity and plurality of human experience and human nature, of the fact that there are many, many paths to good and flourishing lives, that there's not just one great answer, but there are many answers. And this, by the way, is not to be a relativist, not at all. Kant and Hume and others in the Enlightenment were not relativists. On the contrary, they said, of course there are things that we share, a common human nature. And indeed, the shared things are things that should make us sympathetic and tolerant towards one another. And our sympathy and our tolerance should extend to the recognition that we have different interests and different needs, and that those, providing they don't cause harm to other people, are things that we should allow one another, just as we ourselves, each of us, wishes the opportunity or chance to be allowed to make something of ourselves in life. This is a point very, very beautifully captured by George Bernard Shaw in his remark about the Golden Rule, always worth repeating. You remember the Golden Rule says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And Shaw said, under no circumstances should you do to others what you'd like them to do to you, because they may not like it. And it's a very, very good insight. Because if you think that you should do to others what you'd like them to do to you, then you are making yourself the standard, the benchmark of how everybody should be treated. And that's an absurdity. Other people may have very, very different tastes, very different interests, very different abilities and capacities that they could exercise in ways that are not your own. And of course it's important that one should have standards, there should be limits, we should agree, have that conversation that Athene started in Athens about what our shared values and practices should be. But at the same time, we should recognize that on the infrastructure, as it were, the substructure, rather, of a shared humanity, there is great diversity. And that diversity is a good thing. And this gives the juiciest, the ripest of all the fruits of humanism, which is the idea of regimes of human rights and civil liberties. That is the real outcome. That is the consequence of this conversation, this intelligent conversation that people have had since the Enlightenment, when the idea of rights and of liberties really began to take concrete form in our political and social institutions, for example. But in 1948... when Mrs. Roosevelt's Committee on Human Rights presented its draft of a declaration on human rights to the new United Nations, in the shadow of the Holocaust and all the terrors of the war that had just passed, there was a moment when the whole of humanity, you have to remember that on Mrs. Roosevelt's committee there were people from India and China, from the Middle East, from North America, from Europe, so when they presented their document, it was one that they felt all the member states could agree to, and that document was accepted after some debate, of course, but nem con by the fledgling United Nations. What this document did was it recognized commonalities in human experience and human interests. It recognized our shared human basis. Recognize, for example, the fact that none of us particularly like being tortured in dark cellars. Oh, well, I'm sorry, I used to say that, but then 50 Shades of Grey might have changed me. But generally speaking, we don't like that, or being starved or deprived of company, or not allowed to exercise our talents in ways that seem good to us. What it does, what that document does, the UN Declaration, is to ask for a space to be opened around individuals, a protected space, where if they have the energy and the intention, they can do something good with that opportunity. They can do something good with their lives and make choices that matter to them, choices that are not forced on them by others. The fundamental premise of the idea of human rights is that each individual should be given a domain of privacy, of possibility, so that they could make something accordant with their own talents. So it recognizes shared humanity, and it also recognizes diversity in humanity. There's not one mention, other than the article which says people should be free to have or not have a religion, there's not one mention of religion, not one mention of any tradition of divine command. And when you hear religious thinkers say, well, our ideas of human rights and the value of the individual come out of Christianity, for example, or out of one of the religious traditions, that should be resisted. Because, and there are a number of different reasons why, but those ideas really lie with their very deepest roots nearly 1,000 years before Christianity became dominant. In fact, here is the thing that you might point out to people who take that kind of line. When you look just at the documents of the New Testament, you find there a very stringent morality designed for people who quite sincerely thought that they lived at the end of the universe's history. That morality says, give away everything you own. Take no thought for tomorrow. Make no plans. Consider the lilies of the field. Don't marry. If your family disagree with you, and by the way, if you give away all your money, they will, then you turn your back on them. Keep the wicks of your lamps trimmed like the wise virgins, because the parousia, the second coming, is imminent. It's next week or next month or next year. You know, this is the end of time. So you don't need money, you don't need marriage, you don't need plans. You've just got to hang in there, because the kingdom is upon you. Now, after 3 or 4 centuries, and people were looking at their sundials and thinking, this is taking a bit longer than we thought, they had to import a great deal of ethical thinking, and by the way, a lot of metaphysical thinking, because as you know, the early Christians were Jews, and so they, at that time anyway, they believed that when you die, your body lies in the ground. The early Christians thought lies in the ground, and when the last trump sounds, the graves will open and the bodies will arise. St. Paul says, in new, clothed in new flesh or renewed flesh, you've got a rippling six-pack and, you know, you all come out of the grave ready to go. And after those many centuries had passed by, the idea was that since it had been written that the saints will see no corruption, and every time they opened the graves of the saints and just found bones and they had, you know, fully corrupted, they thought that a much more interesting view would be Plato's view about the immortal soul. The idea of an immortal soul comes relatively late into Christianity, after a few centuries, and it is the soul that goes to purgatory to be purged of its sins and finally to achieve beatitude. But much more importantly for our purposes, you think about the substance of what people call Christian ethics, you know, the concept of the kindly, considerate person who helps others, the emphasis on parables like the Good Samaritan and others. These come out of the shared moral outlook of most of the great ethical systems, and certainly all of the ethical systems of antiquity. If you look at Moism in China, for example, brotherly love, love for your fellow human being, lies at the very center of the Moist outlook. You look at any of the schools of thought in the Greek and classical and Hellenic periods, and they all just take for granted that you are going to help those, the widows and the orphans and those who are in need of help. Because of the idea of shared humanity, because of the essentially humanist view about the nature of relationships. And these are the values which reappear in the fruits of humanism in our own time. in the idea of rights and responsibilities of a civil order where, through education, through the law courts, in the theatre, in our literature, we discuss and debate, where we turn over and over and over the ideas that matter to us, that make us fully human. It's proven, if you like, by the omnipresence of CCTV cameras in the public square in our country, that we no longer officially believe in God, because, of course, he used to be the one who saw everything that everybody did always, and now we need cameras for that purpose. Well, we haven't got quite as far as the theistic version of it, because you may remember nobody minded when the cameras were put on the lampposts, but when somebody suggested putting microphones on the lampposts as well, so we could not only be seen but heard, that everybody began to get really all interested in civil liberties suddenly. And that never occurred to anybody beforehand that the idea of the great invisible policeman who saw what you did on your own in bed at night when you thought nobody was watching, that nobody ever thought that that was an invasion of our civil liberties. But of course so it is, the very concept of it and what lies behind it, the concept of control. The idea fundamental to most of the major religious outlooks that we are intrinsically flawed. We've got to be watched, that somehow we're under suspicion, and that we've got to pay for the things that we do, rather than being responsible and accountable to ourselves and to others, and that the payment that we make is to ourselves when, having committed the amartya, having committed the mistake or the error, we have to do better. And that's an essentially humanist idea, doing better. It's an essentially humanist idea that our relationships to other people can be governed by a very simple but very deep insight that they have rights as we each of us do, and that the respect for rights and treatment of them according to those rights is key to the very structure of our society. So that's the fruits of humanism, the fact that we have, most of us, I think, in the more reflective reaches of humankind now, come to see that it is a matter of choice and of responsibility, of thinking things through, of adapting our decisions and actions to realities, and to premising our view of the world on that generous and sympathetic outlook and that realistic, evidence-based outlook, rather than relying on ancient voices whose view of the world, whose derivation really, is a view of the world very, very different from human reality itself. Thank you very much.
Obviously, we're now going to take questions from the audience. There's two roving mics, so if you'd like to pop your hands in the air, then please ask some questions. Okay, first hand. We'll have about 20 minutes of questions. Make them as brief as possible, and do please make them questions, not your own little mini lectures. Thank you.
There's an interesting concept that I learned. It's about theology, but it's called theological non-cognitivism. And it doesn't make sense in some cases if people say to me, Jesus is the Son of God, or Muhammad is the last prophet. But some people get very attached to these concepts straight away. What do you make of this concept?
Well, whenever a label like that has too many syllables in it, you should immediately start getting suspicious. Theological non-cognitivism. Well, one version of it is that that the deity is ineffable, that you can't grasp the nature of deity. Deity is infinite and has all its characteristics in superlative form. So our finite minds are incapable of really understanding the nature of it. So the purposes of deity are inscrutable to us. We can't really understand what's going on. So our objections to tsunamis and earthquakes and cancer in childhood and so on are mark really of our failure to see that there is some greater good and some better purpose which is being subserved. My own view of that argument is that it is you know, there are some other arguments similar to it, but the sort of last refuge of the scandal, because if you're trying to engage with somebody on the question of the nature of deity, and they end up and say, you say, what do you mean by an infinite being? What do you mean by an all-perfect being? An omnipotent being can do anything. Well, can it eat itself for breakfast? Well, no, it doesn't eat itself. But then you begin to find that the concept is very, you know, hedged around with qualifications. And ultimately, the move will be non-cognitivist. We can't know. We can't grasp the nature of it. And then it surprises me. So we can't know anything about God, but by golly, we do know an awful lot of things about what God wants us not to do and to do and so on. You know, so that always does seem to me to be a bit of a conflict. And after all, they say we're non-cognitivist about the nature of the deity, but then they've got a great big fat book which is meant to tell us all about what about it. So I find it, you know, in the not very unexpected way, a sort of mass of confusions. Even though I often tell my students that confusion is the beginning of wisdom, maybe these confusions would be. Yeah. Yes.
What then is the difference between rationalism and humanism?
Well, the term rationalism has a number of different uses in the philosophical and sort of intellectual tradition. One use it has is it denotes a certain family of theories in epistemology, the theory of knowledge in philosophy, where it suggests that genuine knowledge, real knowledge, can only be arrived at by ratiocination, by acts of thought. Deduction, for example, from first principles or self-evident truths or basic beliefs of some kind. But the sense of rationalism that you've got in mind, I think, is the one that the Rationalist Association employs. And there the idea is that our understanding of the world and our approach to life should be rational, that is, rational, proportioned to the evidence that we have, to what we can see and feel and touch, and also by extension of our instruments that make us better able to investigate the world. And our rationality is a proportioning of what we commit ourselves to, and the beliefs that we hold, and the actions that we base on those beliefs, according to our best evidence and reason. In that way, rationalism and humanism are very, very close. Except the nuance of difference is that rationalism is about how we think and how we form our beliefs, and humanism is an attitude to how we live ethical lives. You might say that humanism is a rationalistic approach to the question of ethics. I think that gentleman behind you was first, actually, so we'll be democratic and let him go first. So.
Thank you, that's very kind. I was just wondering, if you had a religious person and a person who follows humanism together, given the criteria that you mentioned for humanism, would you think it's actually possible to declare the religious person more humanist than the humanist person if they were not following the criteria that you mentioned? Does that make any sense?
Well, there are two things that might be said in response. One is that, of course, the word humanism in its contemporary 20th and 21st century sense, denoting as it does this non-religious outlook towards ethics, is an evolved use of the term, because in the Renaissance period there were plenty of religious humanists, that is, people who were really interested in humanity, the human story, life in this world now, but who nevertheless were still attached in one way or another to one of the churches or one of the strands of Christianity. It happens, though, that when you look at Renaissance humanists, and the greatest of them is Erasmus, you find that the connection that they draw between their religious commitment and their humanistic outlook is a slightly tenuous one. It's tenuous for the very good reason that there is a sharp contrast between the attitude of Renaissance humanism and the attitude of the high medieval religious view of the nature of the world, which was that the world is a place of danger and darkness. The medieval mind was one best expressed really in the contemptus mundi literature of the time. that life is nasty and fortunately short. The devil and his agents are waiting to snag your soul and take you down to hell. You look at the murals and altarpieces of the great Gothic cathedrals and churches, and you see their depictions of the risk that we all run of eternal damnation and of the kind of sufferings that we would face if we don't manage to hang on to our faith. But the Renaissance looks at this world, at the sunshine, at the flowers, at picnics in the fields, portraits of ordinary people, lovers, music, poetry, the joys, the pleasures that we had in the flesh, here and now, in this life, in this world. And that is an utterly different focus. So even the religious humanists of the Renaissance period were much more focused on the value of life in the here and now than their forebears were in medieval times. So that is one big difference. But I think you mean something more like a humane outlook. That there might be somebody who has a religious motivation, and out of that has a deep love for his or her fellow human beings, and acts upon that, and is very, very humane. Now, being humane is not the monopoly of any one outlook. People do say that, it takes religion to make good people do bad things, and history is full of examples of that. So very often, inhumanity does seem to be something that comes out of the great cruelty of divisions and conflicts, and I've got the truth and you're wrong, and so on. But it would be a natural thing for a humanist to be, is to be humane. When I talked about that sympathetic and generous understanding of human nature, I mean to include the fact of its frailty and of the flaws, of the needs, of the desires, of the lusts of the flesh, of the fears and timidity, of the appetites that make it sometimes quite difficult to be a human being, of the fact that we can sometimes be crushed by life, by grief, or by failure. And a sympathetic understanding of those things, a humanistic attitude towards the fact that life is an alloy of pains and pleasures, of disasters and triumphs, of difficulties and enjoyments, that understanding is what underwrites the idea of sympathy, the idea that we can feel with our fellows and respond to them accordingly. So by its nature, humanism is, as it seems to me, humane. But it doesn't have a monopoly on that. There can be very good people who have a religion. Some of my best friends are religious.
Good evening, Professor. You mentioned a lot of names and a lot of historical examples. But those historical examples have always sort of lived with flaws, where slaves of their own times, Aristotle, slavery, Cicero, public slaughter, and gladiatorial wars, and even the latest incarnation of humanism as one way of looking at it, is you mentioned the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which wasn't very far away from the segregation that was there. Now, where is humanism right now, and what are the compromises that humanism is making in its current form, and where does it go from here?
Well, you're absolutely right. When one does look back at these very valuable insights that the thinkers of antiquity offered us, they did it from this background, as you say, of slavery and of the fact that most people in their societies were not enfranchised. Women, slaves, foreigners, children, they all had a status which was very, very third class in relation to the people, and they tended to be males over the age of 30 who were natural-born citizens of the state, who were alone fully part of the story. And it was to them and for them that much of this thinking was addressed. When people talk about the democracy of Athens under Pericles, for example, they're talking about a very, very limited section of the populace that had those sorts of rights. Now, these facts, these historical facts you point out, have to be accepted. And I suspect that in centuries hence, in 200-300 years' time perhaps, people will look back at our time and they will find all sorts of things that we do now that we take for granted and think are perfectly acceptable and indeed desirable. And they will be horrified by them.
I don't know. They may look back in 200 years' time and think that monogamy was a terribly bad idea because it was so destructive. We place in our society such a value on it that it does tend to be destructive. So we can't second guess in a way how some of those valuations of things might change. But what we can do is apply our very best thinking to what it was that the philosophers thought in those ancient times, how we can pluck the fruits of them now in a way which is very much more to our taste and much better than in those ancient times, and try to project forward how better to act. I think this gentleman's been very patient.
Yes, there's one thing that seems to me very much an important factor in modern humanism, which I don't really know the roots of, and you didn't explicitly mention anyway. That's the idea of human potential, the idea that we can actually be more than another, other people can be more than they appear to be, and that part of our duty is to find out what is possible and to help them achieve it. Now, what would you see as the roots of that kind of attitude, the idea of increasing human potential?
Well, I rather hope I touched on it in talking about the diversity of talents and capacities that people have for making lives good and for infusing meaning into their existence from those resources that they have. That's very, very much the point that you're making. In antiquity, the idea of educating was, as you know, in Plato, for example, the idea of drawing out those capacities or fostering or nurturing them. And that idea lies at the very base of education right through our system. Now, we do think that it's, you know, we tend to be a bit paternalistic about this, and we do think it's the responsibility of the teacher and the institution to do that work. But really, it ought to be a partnership between the teacher and institution on the one side and the individual on the other, prepared to put the effort, the endeavor into trying to develop those capacities to their very best, because that is a responsibility we have to ourselves. It's a moral responsibility. You know, there's something about the assumptions made by the ancients and by the humanist tradition in itself, some of the things that are not said because they seem so obvious to the ancients. I'll give you an example. In the 18th century, when the authors of the Federalist Papers were discussing what a Bill of Rights should be when one was being contemplated to be added to the Constitution of the new United States of America, one of the suggestions was that there should be a right to freedom of expression. This was turned out to be the Second Amendment. And one of the authors wrote to the others and said, why make freedom of expression a positive right? Surely it's there anyway. If you mention it, it's as if it doesn't exist and has to be legislated for. But surely it is an inherent, intrinsic right that we can speak our minds and put our point of view. Now, that was something that the ancients never discussed. Go back and look at the text of the philosophers. They never discussed the question whether, if you're enfranchised, that you can't say what you think in the agora, or that you can't speak your mind in the jury of citizens. On the contrary, it was just an assumption. So the assumption that you must do the best with your capacities, that you must, you know, accept this challenge to develop yourself physically and to develop yourself morally and to develop yourself intellectually, was just taken for granted. I mean, you look at that great book by Werner Jaeger called Paideia, where he talks about the classical conception of education. You see that there is no debate in ancient times about whether people should be educated. There's only a debate about what form it should take. And that's an interesting assumption for them to make, and it speaks to your point. Yes, you have been very patient too, but we better be geographical in our democracy as well.
Thank you very much. I thought that was a beautiful story about humanism and, you know, beautifully told. And, you know, in regard to religion, I just think it's a bit of a straw target. And, you know, I just wondered what the downside of your position is after you tell this beautiful story with these beautiful references from Cicero onward, Plutarch. These are all wonderful things. But, you know, what's the downside of your position today? You know, we're living in economically straitened times. Can we afford you know, to be overflowing with the milk of human kindness, to be, you know, bubbling up with liberties, you know, if I can't get my feed my kids, you know. So what's your feeling on that?
Does anybody know if there's a downside to humanism here? I think, you know, that another of the fruits of humanism that one could point to, perhaps, is the emergence of the idea of the social responsibility of the community. It is not a matter of individual charity, whether or not somebody gets fed or somebody's children are clothed, but that we as a society can come together and try to some degree to promote a sense of social justice and to help people who need help. In fact, it's been, I think, one of the great achievements of European civilization in the last, certainly in the last half century, but in this country, since the first couple of decades of the 20th century, that we've thought very seriously about how, as a community, we can do our best for those who are worst off in society. In times of straitened circumstances like these, as you say, we begin to get a little less generous, a little less kind to our unfortunate neighbours, because self-interest always kicks in. We're all prepared to be very nice to our neighbours when we're well off. And that shouldn't be the case. In fact, in hard times, it's when the burden should be shared by everybody, and that our concern for our fellows should be at its height. Even somebody who thought that it's in our own self-interest in the long term, to be generous and to help our neighbours. Even somebody who thought that if I help my neighbour today, since I might need his help tomorrow, this would be a good investment in the future. Even that would be better than the kind of view which says everybody's got to fend for themselves and I don't want to be part of any story that helps other people, which is very, very much the sort of American attitude, actually. I remember once when I was a student at Oxford, an American philosopher came to give some lectures on the philosophical justification for taxation, which was a topic surprising to everybody in Oxford, and we couldn't really understand for the first two or three weeks of his lectures exactly what the problem was, and then we clocked it, which was that your average, you know, Republican voter in the United States of America is outraged at the thought that the state should put its hand into his pocket to take a few cents out to give to somebody else because he hasn't, you know, got off his backside, got himself a job. Outraged at the thought that you've got any responsibility in that way to other people. And suddenly, you know, everybody in the room had this kind of gestalt, and we understood why a case has to be made for sharing some of our resources with those who have less. And that is something that we so take for granted in our view of things, that it comes as a surprise that other people just don't see the point and don't agree with it. And now I think that's a humanist view too. Humanism is as much about community and others and responsibility to others as about what attitude we should cultivate and practice and see the world through.
Just as a point, because Professor Grayling only has a little bit left time, maybe just two more questions, shall we
take? Yes, certainly.
Okay. And just want to answer the gentleman at the back as well. If you want, Jan, who's the lady who's running the wine bar at the back, she's also doing part of our Humanist Action campaign. And over the next few months, we're going to be sort of asking you to pop along to a homeless shelter and make any donations to the people at the homeless shelter. So maybe speak to Jan at the back if you'd like to do some humanist action as well. Okay. Any other questions?
Now, this lady has been very patient.
Patient lady.
I just wanted to ask about terms, because I've been hearing this term atheism plus, and it seems to me that people get very attached to the term that they choose to use, whether it's humanist, atheist, or whatever. You said earlier that all it really means is a thoughtful way of living and a way of living where you think about things sensibly. So I wonder what my question really is, what do you think is the value of labels, and are they not just divisive?
Yes, I always warn my students that anything that ends in ism should be approached with great skepticism. one should be very, very careful about all the component features of the thought. But you raised that the atheism plus, by the way, is the feminist version of atheism. It's a feminist way of not believing in God. There are three, and this is always worth remembering, three separable, although naturally connected, debates in this arena. The atheism debate is about what, if anything, exists in or attached to the universe in some way. It's a metaphysical debate about whether there is a supernatural agency or agencies in the universe. And the word atheism, as you know, is a theist's word. And so when they say things like militant atheists, that's a mistake. I always point out to people, everybody knows the comparison. Atheism is to theism what not collecting stamps is to stamp collecting, so you can't militantly not collect stamps, so you can try. So atheism is a metaphysical debate. Then there is secularism, which is about the place of the religious voice in the public square. And any self-respecting secularist will say, of course, the religious voice has every right to be heard in the public square, to put its point of view. Historically, however, the religious voice has been massively overamplified in the public square. We have 26 bishops in the House of Lords, 4 religious programs on the BBC every day, and 3% of the population of England goes to a Church of England service on a regular basis, and this is terribly disproportionate. And so what we want is for the religious organizations to see themselves for what they really are, which is interest groups, like trade unions and other NGOs and political parties. They've got a line that they want to sell, and so they should, you know, be perfectly free to do it, but proportioned to their actual base in society. For those historical reasons, they have this massive megaphone which enables them to be, you know, to drown out other voices or to speak ahead of other people. I often tell people that I go on these panels, you know, to discuss the secularist issue, and there will be a Jewish man and a Muslim man and a Protestant man and a Catholic man, and they're all men because there aren't very many women in the hierarchies of churches, not even after the last synod. And then there's me, moi. And I always say to them, look, the reason why there are 4 of them and 1 of me, even though probably most people in our society are fundamentally secularist, even if they're religious, there are 4 of them because they don't agree with one another. They have spent history fighting and killing one another. Now they make common cause because they want our tax dollars for their faith-based schools. So there are 4 of them and 1 of me. And I'm the token atheist, secularist, humanist. They didn't ask a lady because I've got the hairstyle already. So they've economized. And in this debate, they're going to take up 4/5 of the time. And I'm going to have 1/5 of the time to speak. And this is a very good representation of how it works in our society. And then the third thing is humanism. That's the ethical thing. So you've got atheism, secularism, humanism, and those three isms sort of exhaust the field of debate. You can get religious secularists. Actually, secularism began with the church. They didn't want the temporal powers to control church activity, so they demanded separation of church and state. Now, of course, they're moving in the other direction, especially in America. But it is important to see the distinctions there and to recognize the work that needs to be done in each of those different debates. One more? Yeah?
I'm interested in some of the new moral questions that are provoked by advances in technology, like neuroscience, artificial intelligence, and such like, things that may well affect the next decade, century, I don't know what. Mm. You know, at what point do robots start having moral rights? What are the limitations on the right to read or write people's neural connections and that sort of thing? And this will be so far away from any kind of extrapolation of human experience up to now. Well, do you think that the experience of the last 3 millennia will actually be relevant, or whether we'll have to sort of start afresh?
Well, one major aspect of it will be relevant, which is that the right thing to do is to have a sensible conversation about it and to look at the evidence and to try to reason responsibly from it. That I think, the idea of how you do things, how you go about things, how you come to some kind of determination is the key. Faced with these very, very novel, you know, problems and questions, we can't run in the opposite direction or be frightened or just not have robots and so on. But we've got to embrace progress in that respect, but try to manage it, and try to manage it thoughtfully. Always remembering, of course, that it comes down to the fact that individual human beings are going to be involved in some way, and their interests should lie at the heart of what a humanist thinks and feels. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
And that's it. If you'd like to find out more about the Pod Delusion and listen to other special podcasts or our regular weekly show, just head over to poddelusion.co.uk. Thanks for listening.